Howdy. Thanks for listening to Let the Movie Speak. Before we get started, we'd like to ask a favor of you.
It's a simple favor. If you could just rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen, that might help other ears get into our ecosystem here and hear another episode. Anyway, enjoy the show.
And he's also a real close friend.
Yeah. People talk about you and compare you to Hitchcock. Is that a legitimate comparison in your
estimation? Well, I'm very flattered by that. I really am, I think, more influenced by a director, Howard Hawks. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He did the first version of The Thing from Another World. And I admire his work a lot.
Now, The Thing itself, what are we talking about here? What exactly is The Thing?
Welcome, listeners, to not just another episode of Let the Movie Speak, but a very special spooky episode. That's right, Justin, we're going full spooky. How are you?
I'm doing great, my friend. It's not only are we privileged today in history to talk about The Thing from Another World, but also The Thing from Another Director.
Yeah. Yes, we are doing Let the Movie Speak first. And Justin, I've been told, it's been reported by many very reputable news outlets that no one has ever done this on a podcast before. It's a groundbreaking first.
Right. Yeah. CNN is running a story it's got live updates. I'm watching the feed come through. Anderson is going to be on in a little while talking about this.
Yep.
Yeah. We are breaking new ground.
Yeah.
Frankly, I think this is the first step towards world peace.
Well, not if The Thing has anything to say about it, but, so we're going to compare those two movies, both based on the same source material, but very, very different movies from different times. And
did you think so? I had a hard time kind of watching them back to back. I couldn't really tell where one started and the other stopped.
Yeah, you could cut them one after another and it would be seamless. Before we get started tonight, we should probably do one of our periodic, hey, if you're listening to this, you ought to be following us on all the social medias in your life, including Instagram, Twitter. We're on Facebook. If anyone still uses that, other than your parents. You can also refer to the show notes after the show, everybody. And anything we reference that's worth clicking on, like an interview or an article or something, it'll be down there. And anything you share, subscribe, rate, review, any of that stuff just really helps the show, Justin. And it'll get us to the next planet of listenership. Yeah. I tried to make it back to theme. I couldn't do it.
Right. I think it takes us to the next domain of not just existence.
Right.
But also pleasure.
Okay. And on that very disturbing note, we are going to talk about what we watched this week. Justin, we are nothing if not on theme tonight because this is our spooky season kind of exclusive because the Forbidden Planet was not scary and Body Snatchers is fun, but it's not particularly scary. No. But both of our what did we watch this week's is they are in the genre. And so,
Right?
Did you watch an opera?
I'm sorry, did I miss my cue, Travis? Oh my gosh, I was trying to get it on cue.
Okay.
I'm sorry, man.
We will never try that again. But why don't you try telling the folks what you watched this week?
Well, it was a dark and pretty calm night when I popped on. You can't do that anymore, huh? I'm sure that came from like VHS days,
right?
Oh,
yeah. Used to pop in the tape. Yep.
Anyway, I had the pleasure of watching Werewolf by Night.
Yeah. This is the Marvel werewolf thing.
Yeah, so it's a Marvel thing, Travis. And I know you haven't seen it yet, so I don't want to, you know, get into I'll just try to talk about the big picture.
Yeah, yeah.
This is enjoyable. Okay, we have both.
Wait, stop the presses. Yeah. Did you say enjoyable?
I said enjoyable, and I actually mean it.
Whoa.
You know, it. I don't know, man. It's it's really refreshing. And I think a lot of this has to do with, you know, there's that whole side in Marvel world, at least in the comics, of all this monsters and monster hunters. If anyone related to this show has seen any of the Blade movies with Wesley Snipes, mm-hmm. you know.
Soon to be remade with, what, Mahershala Ali or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, yeah. They just lost their director, like, last week, though, so.
Great sign. It's going to be a great movie.
Yeah. It's been pushed back. You know what's amazing? I think they only pushed the release date back, like, 3 months. They're like, no director.
Wow.
No problem.
That's
we'll get
how you
Orson
know
Welles.
It's a Marvel movie, because it's yeah. like, all you have to do is come in here and, like, call action a couple times. We got it. We got it.
Right. The show must go on.
It yeah. will. Yeah.
So here's what's interesting, I think, why this is enjoyable, because it doesn't even sound like from its conception that Werewolf by Night happened like that, right?
Yeah.
So Michael, so I realized I was saying his name wrong, Travis, for years.
Giacchino.
I was saying Giacchino. Apparently that's not it.
It's Giacchino, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. You're right, man. Holy cow.
Well, to be fair, I realized this like not that long ago as well, because I heard someone talking about how he was directing this movie, and I was like, who the crap is Michael Giacchino? And I looked it up, and it's like...
Who's that imposter?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so Giacchino and apparently Kevin, we don't even need to say his last name, right?
Yeah.
From Marvel, had a little meeting, and Kevin said, hey, Mikey, or Mr. M, I don't know what he goes by. But he said, hey, just let me know what you'd want to do, because they got to talking about the possibility of Michael Giacchino getting involved and doing something for Marvel. And he said, that's easy. Werewolf by Night. And Kevin apparently stopped and was like, what? Really? Are you serious? And he absolutely was. And so maybe it's because, Travis, this isn't a theatrical release, right? And it's just a one off. This is less than an hour. I don't know. What's so great about this show, I think, is that it feels so unencumbered. There are like zero references to anything Marvel anywhere.
Music to my freaking ears. That's wonderful.
And there's no post-credit stinger. It just goes.
It's an hour-long movie? Like, it's a short film, essentially.
So, yeah. So they presented it as like, it says something different in the beginning, too. Like, Marvel Studios special or presents special.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it's
right?
like it's like an old-school TV special. Like, when they used to do like an hour-long TV special, which is really cool. Yeah.
And so I know that we both, I saw the trailer and I thought, oh, there's no way. There is no way I'm not going to watch this.
Yeah.
Know? And so I sent it to you, and I think you had a similar reaction, like, oh, wow, something that actually looks interesting.
Yeah.
So my mom, you know, who I love and who I've talked about a bit on the shows that relates to movies, when I was like six, she started me on the classic Universal monster movies.
Oh, yeah.
I cried at Frankenstein.
Right.
Not because I was scared, though. I was just very sad for him. Go back to our Frankenstein episode if you want more details.
We'll put the link to that in our show notes. Bam.
That's right. Show notes. Yeah. This helps the algorithm, I guess.
Yes. Algorithms. There are overlords and our masters, and we serve nothing but the algorithms.
Humbly. I might add.
They're always
good. Some meekness.
Yeah.
And a little bit of sausage.
And reverence. Yes.
Yeah, so this is a big send-up of those kind of movies, right, in part. And I think that comes through pretty loud and clear even in the trailer.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, that Marvel would allow something besides that one episode of WandaVision to be shot in black and white, I think, says something on its own. So is it perfect? No. But here's what I'll say. If you are a fan of the horror genre, especially like classic, you know, film horror, do yourself a favor and watch this. You will enjoy it. It'll make you feel warm and fuzzy on the inside.
Nice.
A lot of the effects in here, Travis, are practical.
Oh, more music to my ears, Justin. Why didn't I watch this? I should have watched this in time to talk about it together. That was a stupid decision.
Yeah. Well, you can always go to confessional tomorrow, Travis.
I'll confess to the algorithms. I'm sorry, algorithms.
Yeah. We're not talking about the Catholic Church, people. No, we're talking about the algorithms.
Of course not. No.
So, yeah, good send-up of the monster genre. Feels very unencumbered. It's not perfect. I don't want to give you too many details about that, Travis, just in case. But definitely worth your time, I think, because this is the last thing I'll say about this. It actually devotes some time on screen to characters actually like having dialogue with one another that lets you actually know them as a character. And when it happens in particular, and there's one scene I'm thinking about in particular, and it made me happy that was in there, but it also made me a little sad because I realized of how rare a thing that is in Marvel.
Oh my gosh!
Because even if characters are talking, you know, and it is something that does matter, at least in the movie, it's really nothing except to move the plot forward,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just a stepping stone or part of another quest or something.
Yep.
But in this, it's not that. It's just part of who these people are. And I thought, wow, this is like actually a movie. It unfortunately certainly is a lot more of a movie than a lot of the rest of the stuff Marvel's been putting out lately.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're interested in horror, if you're interested in seeing if Marvel can do something different... Also, Travis, I think I'll link an article
in the show notes.
Nice. To an article in the Hollywood Reporter from either this week or last week. He kind of made the thesis or the argument that this opens up Marvel to kind of being freed from a little bit of its constraints that it's self-imposed on itself.
Yeah.
And then it might allow it to reach a wider audience. So it was an interesting article. I'd give it a read if you're interested in that sort of thing. My good buddy, what did you watch this week?
Two questions about Werewolf by Night. One, is it spooky?
Yeah, it okay. is. It is nice. So not, I mean, good heavens. We're talking about The Thing from 1982 tonight.
Yeah.
It does not compare to that.
Yeah, fair enough.
But it is in a... in its own, I will say this, Travis, it's enjoyable. It's more fun than it's spooky.
Okay.
Right.
That's fine.
It's a little bit creepy, but it's not really
concerned with like,
but I think you will be surprised.
Okay.
I don't know if I want to spoil. I'll go ahead. This is by far the most violent thing Marvel's ever done.
Oh, that's what I wanted to hear from this. Yes.
Maybe not compared to like the Blade movies pre-Iron Man.
Yeah.
But
or Punisher Warzone or something like that.
I'm gonna melt your face.
Yeah.
I feel like there were some good one-liners missing from that movie, like in True 8, like because he just blows people's faces off like pieces of melted Tupperware.
Yeah,
right?
No, everyone's and made out of cheese in that movie for some reason.
Man, it's so good. Okay. It's not really. It's really bad.
Okay, my second question about Werewolf by Night.
Yeah,
is Michael Giacchino a legit film director?
Yeah, he is. This short film, whatever you want to call it, I guess it is a feature by Academy standards, has the best sound design of anything bar none in Marvel Universe.
Oh.
And that's because Mike's at the reins, right? He scored it. He did the sound design.
Yeah.
It's great, man. It's
that's
a feast
awesome.
For the ears.
Sweet.
But regarding your question about direction, I think he's got a lot of potential, man. Because
nice.
This is like the first thing he's done. So you kind of like see like the stretching, you know, and he's kind of getting out of his comfort zone and trying some things. This makes me super excited to see whatever Marvel or not. I'm super excited to see what Big Mike does next.
I wonder, you know, not to get too sidetracked here down the spooky, foggy path on the spooky episode. How many Oscar nominated composers have made the transition to the director's chair? That has to be not that many. I have
that
to
has to be a short list that he's at the top of.
Yeah,
is my guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I watched this week a movie that falls nicely in line with our episode today and also our Body Snatchers episode. I mentioned on that episode that there were three big 80s. Remakes of, you know, popcorn flicks from like the 50s or 40s or whatever.
1820s, I think, was the first one you mentioned.
Yeah.
Eli Whitney's Revenge of the Cotton Gin.
Yeah. Pretty cool little flick. The film that I watched this week is David Cronenberg's The Fly, which of course is a remake of a 50s popcorn flick, much like
Vincent Price, right? In the original?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's from 58. And then you've got Cronenberg doing The Fly in 89. Of course, Thing from Another World is 51. And then The Thing is 52. So, I mean, 82. So the gap is the same. Same era where you have 80s directors who are definitely genre guys going in and doing their own thing with a big budget kind of, well, you know, crowd pleaser horror flick. And I don't really want to spoil The Fly. I know it's an old movie and we spoil old movies all the time, but I will say that there are things in it, much like we'll get into when we're talking about John Carpenter's The Thing, that you just have to kind of see to believe what people used to do with practical effects. And both of these movies, The Thing and The Fly, are super gnarly. I think The Fly is probably a little more unsettling in its practical effects gore fest. But that's because it's a much more contained, small-scale story between fewer characters, and it's a much more emotionally driven movie, which we'll get into how The Thing isn't in a lot of ways. And I would recommend it if you like spooky stuff, if you like kind of sci-fi weird stuff, and it holds up. The one thing I will say about it is it's like it's one of those 80s movies that kind of in every direction, right, in every kind of cul-de-sac, we're talking about like, you know, all the type of content that you can find in a movie. It is very 80s, meaning... things go further.
What do you mean, Travis?
Well, I just mean like things go further in the 80s than they do in any other decade. And it's just a vestige of the time. As a perfect...
That's interesting. Do you, okay, if I may.
Yeah.
I have always thought that is true of the 70s. But would you say for your money, the 80s is where things go even further?
So like if we're talking about like sex stuff, here's my take is... And that's what I was referring to is... The casual nature of these things in the 80s, I think, is more like on the surface. It's more all over the place. You can't really get away from it. You know, we're talking about like the movies that have the biggest box office returns, the most, you know, rave reviews for kind of crowd pleaser, big budget, like Ghostbusters, for instance. You watch Ghostbusters and you're like, Ghostbusters is a super fun movie and it holds up very well. But there is a sequence in Ghostbusters, which I don't need to be specific about, that you're watching and you're like, why is this here? You know, it just seems like sort of provocative for no reason. It doesn't really make sense with the movie. It's not really tonally correct with anything else that goes on around it. And so that's just true of a lot of these movies. And
he's talking about the Marshmallow Man at the end.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah. That Marshmallow Man is so sultry, sauntering through the city streets with his little bow tied around his neck.
Travis has a weird thing for mushrooms and marshmallows.
Yes,
so,
I'm sorry.
Watch out for when the Super Mario movie comes out. Yeah, that's all I'll say.
It's going to be bad. I just think in the 70s, you have people who are actively pushing boundaries. And then in the 80s, it's kind of an all bets are off scenario. Yeah. And that's sort of the difference in feel. So anyway, The Fly is worth your time with, you know, a little caveat that like it's definitely an 80s movie. I think the horror stuff in there, the storytelling and the practical effects are really, really strong. So on that note, let's get into a movie and another movie that both are based off of a short story by John W. Campbell Jr. from his short story collection, Who Goes There? And the name of that short story, Justin, is the name of our first film, the Howard Hawks production of The Thing from Another World.
Bum, bada, bum.
I just have to say, there are two amazing taglines today that I want to speak both of them into the microphone. We're going to talk about the 51 film first and then transition into the 82, because I think in a lot of ways, Justin, the 51 movie becomes this really nice template to like pull footnotes from, you know, for John Carpenter. So I think we can kind of filter our commentary about the 51 movie through the lens of the 82, if that is okay with you, buddy.
It's okay with me.
Okay. So the tagline for Howard Hawks' The Thing is, it creeps, it crawls, it strikes without warning. And that is just like, is so decade correct.
We should, you know what we should have been doing in this decade, Travis, because I for my money, this is the decade where it's the most fun, is talk about the taglines for each of the movies.
That would have been a great idea, Justin. I'm glad we're almost done with this season now.
Well, we should definitely do it at least when we get to Some Like It Hot.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
Anyway.
We got a couple left. We got a couple left. I don't think
Check
Alfred
out the show notes for a link to nothing related to this.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think Alfred Hitchcock was big on the taglines, but...
He wasn't big on show notes either.
No.
He was tried reaching out to him for some advice. I haven't heard back. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, he's wandering around the street somewhere trying to walk into someone's camera shot so he could be a cameo. Right. So The Thing from Another World is a, I don't want to say this in a disparaging way, it's a kind of by the book feeling popcorn flick with alien stuff and monster effects and tension and a big score. It is directed in the credits, if you're watching it, by Chris Nyby. However, Howard Hawks, the producer, is an uncredited... It's basically known that Howard Hawks, you know, basically stepped in and directed this movie, had a large amount of control, which was super common for him. He did a ton of these movies in the 50s and I think 60s as well. So, Justin, how would you describe the... We'll get into the plots. They're similar until they aren't anymore. But how would you describe the experience of watching The Thing from Another World?
Well, some of the phrases you mentioned in the beginning, you know, you mentioned the tagline, mentioned the big score. Hopefully those give folks an indicator that this is a very 50s movie, right? It does not ever break out of the time it was made in. That doesn't mean it's all bad, at least to me, but it's very much a product of its time. I think this movie does a great job, especially for the time period, of building a real sense of dread, and it feels kind of ominous.
Yeah.
You know, especially when the guys are, I think it's a good combination, Travis, of, you know, the very beginning, there's some really good dialogue written in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought so too.
With an understanding of what genre we're talking about.
No question. Yeah.
But it's really fun. It's very lively. I feel like, you know, a lot of these characters are real in the genre they exist in, at least.
Yeah.
Certainly not people I'm going to bump into on the street, but that's okay. And so when they go up to the North Pole, I thought the change of location for this adaptation was kind of fun too.
Yeah.
Because it gives an excuse to, there's a little bit closer of a link to humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads to, I think, a lot less scary of a tone overall.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, help is just an anchorage, guys. It's not that far away.
Right.
You know, I mean, Alaska's huge. It is far away, but, you know, a little closer than Antarctica.
This is true. Yes.
Where the original story takes place and where the John Carpenter's version takes place. So I really enjoy my favorite sequences, I think, in this movie are probably when they're out initially on the ice.
Yeah.
And, you know, circling the UFO that's crashed and kind of all that leads up to that. That's really good. I think as far as tone from there and how I kind of reacted to it, once you actually see the monster and bless James Arness for being willing to put on the rubber suit.
Oh, yeah.
It looks... you know, John Carpenter was very kind when he said something like the monster in this movie is unremarkable. It's a very charitable way of putting it. And again, product of its time, right? This is just the way we did monsters back then.
Yeah.
And so it's just, but for me, they don't thankfully spend a lot of screen time showing it.
No,
but
no,
at the end when there's no real attempt to kind of, you know, shoot around it or do shadow lighting, or it's just boom, there's James Arness, but he doesn't have his six guns on today. So it takes a lot of the tension out of the room for me.
Yeah.
It's still an enjoyable movie, but for you, I wonder, Travis, because I think, and maybe it has more to do with horror, it's kind of your wheelhouse more than mine. What was your kind of, as you're watching the whole movie, did you feel the same about or differently about kind of the building of dread and tension in the beginning, or what was your overall take of the kind of flow of this movie?
I think this movie works really well for like all of the contexts considered. Like you're saying, like the modern understand, like every time we watch a horror movie, it's like it's the barometer is The Sixth Sense, it's Silence of the Lambs, it's John Carpenter's The Thing, it's Psycho. And those just don't exist yet. And so I think people's goals in making these movies was less to like get under your skin and terrify you at an existential level than it was to just like create tension and kind of relieve that tension in fun kind of roller coastery ways.
Yeah.
And at the best of times, movies like this are, in fact, populated by real human beings, not just cardboard cutouts. And so I think you touched on two things that I do agree with. Like the way it builds tension is really good. John Carpenter, in an interview one time, I believe the interview was about Halloween 1978, his breakout movie. and he was describing the difference between just storytelling about like the boogeyman, you know, and he's talking about there's, you know, a shaman or a medicine man sitting around the campfire and they're telling their tribe the evil is out there. It's in the bushes. It's coming to get us. And then there's the evil inside you, you know. And he said, and that second story is one that is a lot harder to tell, but perhaps a little bit more rewarding as a scary story when you do tell it. And I think that's the clear difference between these two adaptations is The Thing from Another World is about the evil out there. It is very much about the other, you know, the alien conception in the early 50s is all about fear of the other in a lot of ways. And that could be a stand-in for a lot of things, but certainly the Cold War, you know, plays a part in that. And so I think one thing I really like about it is, and this is another, I'm just going to reference John Carpenter because it seems like the episode to do it. He mentioned, and I think in that same interview when he was talking about his version of The Thing, that something they do really well in this one, and I think the right way to watch The Thing from Another World, Justin, is to have seen John Carpenter's The Thing and then watch The Thing from Another World and then rewatch The Thing, you know, from 1982. Like,
yeah, sort don't of how, do it in the same day, though, or you might kill yourself.
Yeah, I just mean, like, if you have it in the back of your mind, like, oh, I know what The Thing is. I've seen John Carpenter's 1982 film. And then you watch the original and then, you know, maybe shortly after that, re-reference the 82 version. I think that's when it's probably going to shine the brightest. Yeah. Because he mentioned that this movie does a really quirky, interesting thing with doors. There are constantly doors being shown on camera, closing and opening and closing and opening. There's even dialogue about it. Shut that door. It's cold, you know? And like that's said, I don't know, probably half a dozen times. It's like, get the door, you know? And obviously people do say, get the door, especially when you're in cold places, but it is purposeful. It's purposeful. And the reason it works to draw attention in a movie from 1951 that you might see at the drive-in or on the big screen as a double feature or whatever is eventually, you know, when that door swings open, there's going to be something on the other side, you know, and
right.
That's when you get the monster. And so I think while, yes, I do agree that like looking through modern lens, it's like, oh, that's a guy in a suit with some funky gloves on. I think the initial reveal, the like bam moment of it just being there, the one time they swing the door open really works, you know. And then the more time the actor in the suit spends on camera in any given shot, it sort of demystifies it and makes it a little less creepy. But Justin, I think I agree. The two things I love about this movie are it does build tension nicely. It does find its way to an interesting kind of fun popcorny climax nicely. And the characters in it are really like fun to be with. They're warm and relatable in their decision-making. None of them are like so stupid and nonsensical. You've got like, you know, Kenneth Toby playing Captain Patrick Henry, who's like, you know, our hunky leading man in a bomber jacket.
His name is Patrick Henry, for crying out loud. How are you going to beat that?
Seriously. But I did want to ask you one thing about the characters in this movie, because you got him, the protagonist, and then you've got Dr. Arthur Carrington, who's like...
I prefer Darthur. I prefer that name.
Darthur Carrington. He is like the science above all else, and forget it if we die. This is an important discovery. You know, that's sort of that archetype being played out in this movie. But what did you think about the romantic subplot in this movie, which is going to be completely missing from Carpenter's version? It's just interesting that like this is from an era where that was part and parcel. It's like you got a hunky leading man. There's got to be somebody interested in this guy. Look at him. You know, he's strong. He's brave. He's courageous. He's good looking. So we throw a female in mix. But I have to say, for me, Justin, and I want to get your take on this, I thought this kind of worked. Like, it doesn't always, you know, but I think they're both kind of believable. And their interplay, like you said, the dialogue between them is like when they're just alone and kind of quiet times. I found that all very like convincing and sort of compelling.
Yeah, I'm with you, man. Again, you know, recognizing the genre that this movie exists in. So I wouldn't certainly be like, well, if you want a really realistic depiction of 1950s relationships, here you go. But that said, I think, at least for me, why that works and why I think I enjoyed it for some of the same reasons you did is because they feel like they're playing on an even plane level.
Yes.
I think it really represents the kind of best that men and women can bring out of each other in that kind of relationship. I mean, it's pretty obvious. They talk about getting hitched and they're sitting down cuddling up next to each other at the end. So
yeah
it seems pretty clear that they are intending to be wed. So it's interesting that the whole lead up to that, though, done in such a way where he doesn't just come and sweep her off her feet.
Yeah.
Or she's not just some shrinking violet that needs some dude to save her. It's really played a lot more fairly than probably, especially for the genre. I mean, that's got to be pretty rare for the era anyway.
For sure.
But even just for 50s in general, it gives her a lot of what's one of our hot button words today? Agency.
Yeah.
Gives her a lot of agency. Yeah, it's we have our own theme song we're working on. It goes like, agency, it's for you and me. But if you and me are women, agency. So we'll get that polished up for you here
for
shortly.
Sure.
Anyway, so yeah, I think there's just a real dynamic there that's believable where, you know, in relationships that work anyway, a man doesn't just like come in and be like, hey, I'm going to dominate you now, I'm the best. And she's like, oh, sounds good.
Yeah.
You know, and vice versa. It's not like, hey, how's it going, honey? I'm going to seduce you. Okay, I guess we'll get married now. You know, it's
I mean,
the latter, sadly, might be a little more, that may happen more often in the real world. But anyway, this movie doesn't do that. And I don't know, I find it interesting too, Travis, that the movie seems to be in less of a way than like The Thin Man, which we talked about in the 30s series.
Yes.
Thin Man portrayed marriage in a really positive light,
mm-hmm.
right? As like this time that men and women could just really build on each other, be mutually beneficial. And so this is interesting because here's this guy that's this, he's got a great job or a job anyway that people in the country, in his place of work, around the world, if they hear that he's a pilot in the Air Corps, the Air Force, you know, that commands a lot of respect. But while you don't know his ultimate fate at the end, it seems clear that he might just like, well, I guess I'm done with this military life. I'll just settle down and have a family. And the movie paints that as like, that's fine for that character. That's a good thing. Which is certainly not the messaging that we get, especially with kind of in tandem with some of the loosening boundaries that you've mentioned in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So,
yeah.
Anyway, but what were your thoughts about the female and male relations there?
I just think it works really well, and I think you're dead on. And I don't want to reiterate anything in a redundant way. I think she has, you know, a real character to her, for lack of a better term. Like, she's not anything like what you get from your Forbidden Planet time machine, just like, you know, but beyond the, like, you know, is she a feminist character or something like that? She just seems like a real person, you know? And I think, even up till the end, she's not like some fainting, you know, like helpless, hapless person. She's actually like part of the action. I think at one point she asks, you know, to be armed and, you know, like, I don't know. It all feels like what if this very fantastical thing happened, it might play out something like this, you know, and then there's some Hollywood shellac on top of it and it's fine. You know, I think it's fun. Let's talk about the ending so that we can jog forward to what, 31 years into 1982. This movie ends, Justin, with the Thing being defeated. What do we make of this ending for this movie in this year? What do you think?
It's a pretty neat bow,
which
is pretty common for the genre in the time and just movies in this time. To me, it's maybe the worst example of whatever kind of credit that can be given to this movie for the kind of thought and the creativity that went behind making tension really palpable and be impressionable. It's really diminished, and by the end, when they zap the monster, I kind of don't, like, I already know what's going to happen.
Sure.
You know, it feels like a pretty foregone conclusion, not having seen it before. It just, all the railroad tracks are headed right for that little mound that James Arness turns into.
Yeah. Literally, he's being walked down a set of cavernous tracks, a trail,
exactly.
And it's like, there
he goes. Come a little closer. Dun, 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 dun.
And it's over.
So, for me, man, it's just, it's fine.
Yeah.
But the ending of the monster anyway, it's like, okay, it served its purpose. What I think one of the things that also sticks with me the most is the care and the humanity that is in that those last couple shots where Scotty, the newspaper man, is sitting down reading out, you know, giving the news
to that's
someone.
Good.
Finally, he's finally able to get his story out. And he phrases it in a way that's not quite the truth of what happened, you know? He puts some shellac on it, too.
Yeah.
To kind of make some people look better that otherwise would suffer a massive loss to their dignity.
Yeah.
And just the interplay, you know, one guy says, good for you, Scotty. There is just something really powerful, I think, in the simplicity of the portrayal of all those characters kind of together.
Yeah, that's the difference. This is the perfect pivot point because by the time that movie ends, I don't want the Carpenter ending on this movie. You know, like, and I agree it is par for the course, but like it's okay in 1951 in this kind of a movie to just be like happy that most of them, if not all of them, right, like made it out and like won, you know. That's the feeling that this movie seeks to leave you with, and it succeeds. And now, Justin, we get into a movie that has zero interest in leaving you with that warm fuzzy. Let's talk about John Carpenter's 1982 remake of The Thing.
So for this movie, Travis, and compared to The Thing from Another World, I had not seen the 50s version ever before.
Yes.
How many times have you seen either of these movies that we're talking about?
I had not seen the 51 yet. It was my first time. And this one, the 82 version, I have seen probably three times, you know, total before today, I would say. I think I saw it for the first time when I was like 15 and then rewatched it a couple times over the years. And I hadn't seen it for, a couple years. Probably a couple years ago I watched this movie.
Okay.
How about you?
Yeah. It'd been a couple years for me too. First time I had seen The Thing from Another World, because when I saw The Thing, probably around the same age as you the first time, and then I heard, it's a remake of this other one. I went, that's nice. You know, I just have no desire to, you know, like how would you possibly top this movie?
Yeah.
I think, Travis, this is next to Star Wars.
Yeah.
This is one of the, if not the movie I have seen the most in my life.
Okay.
I think it might be like over, I don't know, between a dozen and two dozen times.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I've seen it a lot of times.
You're what we might call familiar with this film.
But I mean, it had been several years though, and I was so excited to get to watch this again.
Yes.
And man, I had even, you know, I just knew I love everything about this movie. And so even just from the very beginning, Travis, you don't even get any footage. But the genius of John Carpenter's musical tonalities, it immediately brought me back.
Yeah.
And I realized that's the first thing that should clue you into the tone and the power of this movie.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about that, right, is that this is technically a score by the man himself, right, Ennio Morricone. But someone else was supposed to do the score, Jerry Goldsmith, who's like a big time writer. And you could tell what Morricone is doing is Carpenter. There's no question about it. You've seen like Escape from New York or, you know, Christine, any of the movies that he scores, and he scores most of his own movies, that doom, 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 that is Carpenter's heartbeat. You know what I mean? So I think you're right. It's the perfect tone setter to start the thing off.
I don't, you're way more familiar with Carpenter than me, Travis, but would you say, because clearly Ennio Morricone is just a savant of music.
Yeah.
Did he kind of perfect is this as good as a Carpenter-esque score has ever been?
It's really up there. Carpenter in his long run from Halloween up through, well, this movie kind of broke him for a while. It kind of knocked him off trajectory because it was critically savaged and a total bomb at the box office. But everything in that run from like 78 to the late 80s that he scores is, I think, really good. Honestly, it established a genre of movie scores that now people are totally aping. You know what I mean? Like you can't watch Stranger Things or anything with that sort of synthy 80s throwback, late 70s throwback kind of sound. That's Carpenter, like no question. So this is up there. Halloween is definitely up there. The Christine score is really good too. So I am very not biased when it comes to these things, but I think this one is either one or two on lots of people's lists of favorite John Carpenter scores. Yeah, it's
okay.
It's really good.
Yeah. So, okay, Travis, here we are. We're walking in now to Antarctica. We've gone to the other side of the world.
Yes.
In this movie. What's your first indicator, Travis, that this movie's doing something a little different than the first movie?
Oh, the first shot? I mean, okay, so this is one of those comparisons where, like, this is why I wanted to do this episode, Justin. It is so worth comparing these movies. And it's not just to, like, dump on one of them as opposed to the other one, because they're so different. And yet it is a perfect example of two creators, two different types of movie makers, Howard Hawks and John Carpenter, and the stylistic choices in the opening few shots of Carpenter's film are like, they're so brilliant. You know, it immediately you get these huge snowy vistas, you get this helicopter chasing a dog shooting at it, which ultimately, immediately rather, feels like wrong. You know, like, you don't see people shoot at dogs in movies. And so immediately you're off kilter, like, what the crap is going on here? And the other movie, is the opposite, I feel like. The opening scene is a bunch of guys around a card table that's trying to, like, get you into their circle of friends and introduce you to them as human beings. And I think one thing, Justin, that we can expand on when we talk about Carpenter's version is, I think his goal is to write people in a way that is convincing, but just up to the line of making them real characters, you know, in this movie. Like, most of their archetype kind of things are very, very minimal, almost surface level. Everything that happens in this movie is set up to get you into that tense, you know, really tense, like, what? Like, last whole hour of this movie is like, grip your
yeah.
seat.
Oh, yeah.
Good. And if they are too humanized, too distinct, too easy to read, almost in a Body Snatchers level when people are transformed in that movie and they're supposed to be like automatons, you know what I mean? If they're too colored in with bold colors, right? Like, you're not going to have that, oh crap, who is it? You know, which is the whole thing, you know, near the last. So that's what I think is really masterfully done. You're watching it, right? And as the scenes are unfolding and starting, this dog is getting shot at. This Norwegian dude is getting, you know, crazy, and they have to gun him down. Immediately, you believe that these are real people, but Carpenter forces you to keep them at arm's length, and you can't really get to know any of them. You're isolated in that icy wasteland with those opening shots, and everybody feels like they exist together, but they're not that same bunch of dudes sitting around a card table. You know, it's not that warm kind of, these guys really know each other kind of feeling. That's my first indicator, Justin. What about you?
Yeah, I would agree. It's from the first shot, and it doesn't let up until the very end. I was really interested to find out, you talked about characterization. St. Roger Ebert, his review of this movie was not kind.
Scathing, yes.
As was, as you said, a lot of the reviews, right? Yeah. People were super grossed out by the effects, which I would say, like, duh. I mean, they are gross. They are horrifying.
Yeah.
And so mission accomplished. I think, which is interesting to me too, because it's not like anyone, at least from reviews I could find, Travis, please let me know if you found something that did talk about this, but nobody seemed to talk about, like, John Carpenter made this and it's super gross. I really don't like the effects, but this is why I think he did it.
Right.
Everyone just kind of went, these effects are gross. And that was the end.
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
So I thought that was a little odd to be so surface level, but I guess that was the strength of the reaction, maybe.
Yeah.
But behind that. So Roger Ebert's review, again, he was super critical of the characterization, saying that people are just pretty much cardboard. Nobody's really, you know, fleshed out. Everyone's kind of a stereotype. And I thought, oh, Roger, how can we have such a different viewing of this movie?
Sure.
Because one of the reasons that I keep going back to this movie, and will probably continue to if I am blessed with long life, is because I believe in every single one of these characters, right? And it's not because I see them around a card table really having some brothers-in-arms camaraderie like the first movie. It's because I believe I can see myself in all of them.
Yeah.
And I think that's, there's a huge sense, right? Paranoia gets thrown around a lot. Like, that's the chief end goal of this movie. It's not, in my opinion, although paranoia clearly exists in this movie.
Yeah.
But there seems to be a strong thread of, you know, you can't, if you, these people don't even know themselves, it seems like, right? Everyone, like, think about the kind of personality that would want to go to Antarctica.
Yes.
For the winter. That's not like your normal, like, Travis, I don't know about you. I'm not planning to go to Antarctica, like, ever, right? It's just not,
yeah.
I mean, like, I don't know. Maybe if there was some super amazing, like, hey, you want to take a helicopter tour with Werner Herzog and go to Antarctica? Sure, why not?
But as, like, you can see out the right side of the helicopter, there
oh,
are,
man, that's not bad.
There is yeah, more we should, ice.
Yeah, he has a really interesting documentary, Encounters at the End of the World.
Oh, he has a lot, but yeah, all, Grizzly all Man,
well,
also amazing.
But related
yeah.
to this, Travis,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's in Antarctica. It's really good.
There's, I mean, you know, creepy things so, that duh. Eat you in but, Grizzly Man, so it's really...
Yeah, no, Grizzly Man's great, too.
It's that's really good. One.
Anyway, yes, Werner Herzog aside, it's just, you know, I feel like the movie asks maybe more of you as a viewer to kind of, I think it's super interesting you share that quote from Carpenter talking about the evil within, you know, or the monster inside.
Yep.
Among your group or among in yourself. I think this movie asks you, at least asks me, to look internally.
Yeah.
A little bit and like, well, what is really the problem, right? I mean, like, okay, yes, there's an alien running around. That's a problem, right? But why is it, why does it come so close to, and I know there's different readings on this, it's not mine, but why does it come so close to killing everyone in the movie? And I feel like part of that answer is that these are people that from the get-go, they're again with the card table, Travis, they're not starting out together,
right.
Really in sync.
No, they're separate.
They're all there for who knows what reason, but I'm going to bet my bottom dollar none of them are there because they have super happy, large families and friends back right. home waiting for them.
There's militaristic, like, threads here, right? Like, I mean, like, I have two brothers in the military, and so, like, I know from their experience, not from my own, that, like, you know, like, organizations that require you to go away for a long time, they just, certain people tend to gravitate towards those yeah. lifestyle choices, right? And that's not true of everyone. It's a total, you know, blanket statement. But that's what this movie, I think, gets at, Justin, that you're saying is, like, immediately... They start off separately, and then when they have to come together to defeat something, therein lies the real conflict. Yes, the alien yeah. is there. Yes, there's a monster, and it's terrifying and horrifying in every way. Like, if people, first of all, I want to try, Justin, if we can, to not get as totally deep into spoilers as we normally do, because this is one of those movies that I hold in, like, a special glass case.
Okay.
I would love to sit next to someone who's watching this for the first time. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I would just love to watch someone else watch this movie. So, like, I want to touch on sequences, and, you know, we can go for some plot details, and we'll talk about the ending, but maybe we'll do a little, like, hey, spoilers coming, you know, kind of a thing. But what I really love is that when things require unity, John Carpenter's theme that he keeps ringing the bell of is, like, people are inherently out for themselves. You know what I mean? And, like, even our protagonist, even, you know, at times there's this shades of all of these characters that are like, they're people who want to, like, have the group come together. But when everybody gets put in that pressure cooker, it's like they just turn, you know, they turn for even just little moments or big decisions. So I think, Justin, the first little clue that we get of that is when they get the news that this Norwegian base or whatever, this is where the helicopter came from. And so who is it? It's Kurt Russell and...
It's the doc. Isn't it Copper, the doctor?
Copper, yes. They're wandering around this wonderful set, by the way. This thing was shot in Alaska and I think parts of Canada and a bunch of sound stages in LA, if you would believe that by watching this, because you could totally sell me on the idea that this movie was all shot on some kind of location, not necessarily
right.
Antarctica, but it's all blended really well. But I love that John Carpenter, he starts to set up the splintering amongst the people with the visualization of the brutality of the thing, right? So like you don't see the thing, but you see what the thing has done to people. And what I mean by that is the first like real human dead body, not just sort of amalgamation monstrosity thing we see, is the guy who gets shot in the opening sequence. And then the next thing we see is a guy in that Norwegian base who has killed himself. And so it's like this idea that like this movie is going to hold everything about the horror, like in the shadows until it isn't anymore, but it's planting the seeds, right? This dread that just builds and builds and builds until it crescendos with all of those practical effects that I think, the minute they see that guy in the chair, Kurt Russell is like, we're getting out of here. You know what I mean? Like we are going back. And so I want to talk about Kurt Russell for a second, Justin, because I think we're both reasonably big fans of this guy. I really like Kurt Russell. He's a pretty cool dude. What do you think about his portrayal here? There's a few different sides to Kurt Russell, right? Because he started out as like a Disney movie star, like in a bunch of like, you know, kind of family comedies. And then he finds himself in these Carpenter movies in the 80s. And this is where he starts to, not this movie because it bombed, in other movies like Big Trouble in Little China or whatever, that's when he starts to like be a bankable leading man character where he is the face on the poster, you know? And in this, I find his portrayal really nuanced and interesting. And like, he spends a lot of this movie, like you said, Justin, alone. So how do you take his leading man characterization in this thing?
I love it, and I think it was an interesting choice that he ended up being kind of the leading man, it sounded like originally, at least from one of the producers that was on there, show notes, who has a little bloggity blog us about the happenings and the creations of this movie that we're talking about, that originally it was not really clear that Kurt Russell, he wasn't the central character.
Yeah.
In this movie. And through editing and some kind of minor reshoots, John Carpenter chose to make him that. I think that was a wise choice. I say that when we don't know much about some of the other characters.
Yeah.
But everyone in this movie is really good.
Yeah.
Even though they are asked to do a lot. That's not fair to say they're not. They're not asked to do a lot in terms of like amount. But in terms of power and what they've got to do for the short amount of time that most of them are on screen,
oh, yeah.
They're asked to do a lot.
Yeah.
And they all bring it. And so Kurt Russell does have to do more just in terms of time, what's given on screen.
Yep.
And he somehow is able, Travis, when we talked about that couple, the romantic relationship in the original Thing movie. And I just want to talk about Kurt Russell's romance with the refrigerator. No, I'm saying that I really like that Kurt Russell is portrayed not like as the protagonist that has it all figured out, right?
No, there's not at all. Yeah.
There's a real, like, that's why I brought up the romance originally, like that we kind of believed that romance in those characters. I believe this guy, he's just trying to figure it out, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he clearly, we won't do spoilers, but he does not have it all figured out, right? And that has some consequences, good and bad.
Yeah.
I appreciate that it's really grounded. And when you talked about, you know, everyone is inherently out for themselves, which I'd have to agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with the premise of the movie in that regard. I think what is cool about this movie is that although it's been accused of being very nihilistic,
mm-hmm.
I think that is such a stupid take. Mm. I want to use strong language. Because stupid, like that strong language today. Oh, what is it, 1934?
I'll bleep
he
it.
He called me a nincompoop.
I'll bleep it. Don't worry, man.
Yeah, thank you.
I got your back.
But it's just like Kurt Russell and the rest of the team, although he kind of becomes the de facto leader.
Yeah.
They show that like, okay, we are all selfish, but we are not going to survive if we're just on our own.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
So we have to try to band together, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's a great showing of the conflict between like, I really just want to be selfish and do what I want, but also, man, this sucks. I'm in this world with other people, and I really do need community if I'm going to have any kind of life, and definitely if I want to defeat aliens from 100,000 years ago that came from billions of miles away.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, man, I love that there is a lot of nuance, and it's very Kurt Russell-y, Kurt Russell-y in how he plays it. But perhaps most importantly, Travis, the cowboy hat.
Oh my gosh, it rules. Yeah.
That thing is so awesome. And I don't it is like it's so ridiculously fun.
Yeah.
And yet kind of right up on the line, kind of like something else you said earlier, it straddles right up on the line of just being like, what the heck is like, yeah, I can't take this seriously.
No question.
But yet, because of that character of RJ McCready, I mean, I believe it too. It's like, yeah, that character did bring that hat all the way to Antarctica.
Yeah.
That dude is probably from some cattle family in Texas or something.
Yep.
Yeah, that's his hat.
Yeah.
You got any thoughts on Mr. Russell's performance here?
He's so good, man. He's so good. And like, you're right in the consequences department. Like the way he portrays a guy who is thrust into the position of leader of this crisis, you know, there's an alien loose. That's not a spoiler. There's an alien loose. It can take different forms, and he is tasked. He's handed the gun, you know, and therefore the authority in that moment. And it doesn't feel like he wants it. He says, like, I think someone with a cooler temper or a more even temperament should probably do this. He says that to Childs, played by Keith David, who is also amazing in this movie.
Oh, my goodness.
But yeah, everybody's amazing. And the character names are amazing. McCready, Childs, Blair,
Windows,
Clark, Windows. Yeah, that's one of those things, right, where they give them one name. And there's something kind of military about, you know, calling someone by their last name or their nickname or whatever. But also, like, I do think that's a purposeful choice to, like, if you knew their first and last name, you might get a little too acquainted. You know what I mean? And you got to keep them at arm's length to make the tension there. Let's talk about some good sequences, man, because the tension is what it's all about in this movie. What's the first sequence that really gives you the willies in this thing and really just, like, works in the spooky department?
The dog kennel.
Ugh.
That's the hardest scene in the movie for me to watch.
Is it because it's dogs? It has to be partly because it's dogs, right?
It is and it isn't, right? Because I'm not one. I love animals.
Yeah.
Okay. I have this weird, like, in my family, it goes back generations. It's probably like we should belong in the insane asylum or something. But on my dad's side of the family, we all like just talk to animals. Like it's totally normal.
Yeah.
You know? And I know some people talk to their dogs or whatever, but we're like out talking to like deer and asking for directions to the buffalo. And it's just, it's a little bonkers, right?
But full on sentences, not like, hey buddy, but like, excuse me, ma'am, can you point me to the nearest gas station?
Yeah, it's more like that, unfortunately.
Okay.
They rarely answer back, but when they do, my camera's never working. I'm not one of those people. That said, like, I do love animals, but I'm not one of those people that's like, you know, oh man, I don't really get bothered on the news when I hear someone gets murdered, but if I hear about animal abuse, I go nutso, you know. Like, that's not, no, I think people do have more value than animals.
Sure.
Animals have value too, but anyway, so it's not just because it's dogs, although that's part of it. I think it's let's use our A word again, agency. But this time we're talking about animal agency. The dogs are locked up in a kennel, so they can't get out from a thing, right?
That's
Here's one thing I do really, okay, whoever trained that dog, and they actually credit the person in the end, Norwegian dog trainer.
It's incredible.
Dude, that dog is trained so good. Let's contrast that real quick with the thing 1951, where the thing is out in the snow fighting the dogs.
Oh my gosh.
And one of the dogs in the foreground is just looking off in the distance like, yeah, whatever.
Okay, did you notice in that sequence in the 51, though, there is a super gnarly moment because the thing, the guy in the suit, isn't like foregrounded and like, and he's like kind of a silhouette and it's like you can't really make it out, but he is like, he has a dog in his arms and he's whipping it around. Like, I thought that was really freaky because you could see the silhouette of the dog like smacking back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah.
I was like, holy crap, this does not feel like 1951 for a moment. But you're right. The dog in the 82, he's a good boy. He's such a good boy.
He is a good boy, man. Just, and I really mean that because like the way that dog, like the when he comes down the hallway, right, that first time, and then he just goes and he sits in the room where you just see the shadow on the wall. It is so, he's not looking at the cameraman wherever they place the trainer. It's just perfect, and you totally believe this dog. Like, you know, knowing what you know later, right?
Yeah,
that the dog is not really a dog.
Yeah,
it's just, it looks like the dog or the thing is really thinking, right? Like, is anyone there?
The dog practically emotes. You know, it's so weird. Like,
it's so good.
Yeah.
So I think part of that, of why that scene is so hard, is yes, it is because it's dogs and because they just don't have the same capacity. They can't go like, you know, you know, Childs, burn it. You know, they can't do any of that. Yeah. So they just bark their heads off. And that one dog, that so good effects, man, where that dog jumps up and they make it look like he's biting the chain link apart.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the dogs, beautiful. They can't get away, like you said.
They can't.
And things,
right, they can't.
Things happen to the dogs in that sequence that they are some of, like, horrible things happen to human beings. And those images, those will never leave my memory bank, I don't think. But the dog stuff, like, I think is equally freaky because it's before we've seen the thing attack any human beings, and it just makes you wonder, like, what is this thing going to do when it gets its hands on a human being? You know what I mean? It's like,
exactly.
It's so gnarly. Yeah.
Now, and if we could talk about the gnarliness, Travis, just, you know, without doing spoilers or whatever, like I said before, it's super gross.
It's gross.
But for I'd be curious to know, okay, because I know that I don't have the same tolerance. It's just not like my preference.
Yeah.
Movies that generally have this kind of stuff. But I give this movie a fat old pass because it feels very intentional and it feels like there's real purpose behind it. But I'm curious for you, is this movie just full of really gross, but kind of from a creative standpoint, really amazing practical effects? Or for you, do they mean anything more than that?
So Rob Bottin is the makeup artist who did this movie. And I will name a few more of his credits for you quickly. Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. He was an assistant makeup artist on that little movie, that indie film.
Yeah, small indie production.
He did The Fog with John Carpenter. He did The Howling, which is has a very famous werewolf transformation sequence in it. He was on Twilight Zone, the movie. RoboCop, Total Recall, Seven, David Fincher's Seven, the original Mission Impossible, Fight Club, and then even as recently as 2014, he did something on Game of Thrones. So this guy is like top tier makeup effects artist. And what I think really works is people forget that although we do kind of crap on CGI often, most of the time, at least for me, Justin, it is not about the medium. It is about the way the medium is used. And so, just like CGI can and is used effectively a lot of the time, honestly, if the story's not there, if to quote ourselves, it's not saying much of anything, there's no room for forgiveness. There's no room for like, well, I can either look past that or accept it, or it worked because of A, B, or C. Because there's no A, B, or C. You know, this is just surface level dreck. The reason that the effects in this movie are so freaky and work so well is because the story, man, it makes you ask things about whether or not you would do this in that situation. It makes you think, I mean, body horror, right? This is an entire subgenre, body horror. Things like The Fly, things like this. In the more modern age, you're talking about like what people used to refer to as like torture porn, you know, like the Saw movies and stuff like that. The reason that that genre exists is because it forces you to come face to face with your mortality, right? It immediately makes you think of like, oh, I thought I had control over this thing called my body, and this movie is making me reckon with the fact that I could wake up tomorrow and something could be horribly, horribly wrong, you know? And so it's an amped up sci-fi version of that. But in the end, the idea that this thing could be inside of you and then come out in all of these different grotesque ways, in addition to that this thing could be inside of your friend and be masquerading as a person, you know, like all of that really messes with our sense of agency over our own forms, you know? And so to answer your question, it all works because it's beautifully, beautifully done. Like we're talking like top tier level artistry with foam rubber latex and, you know, corn syrup and all of this animatronics, not to mention John Carpenter absolutely knowing how to shoot this stuff. You know, you can have practical effects that maybe are manufactured as well as this, but don't come off as effective as this in the movie because they're lit too much, or the shot holds too long, or they don't do the reverse shot so that tongue coming out of that thing looks like it's really whipping around grabbing stuff. So I think it all works, Justin, for me because it hits me on an under the epidermis level, and it's just executed so well by Rob Bottin. You know, like this stuff is peak like 80s practical effects glory right here. And not just on a visceral, like, oh man, cool blood, but like there's enough humanity in these characters, just enough, right? That when this stuff happens to them, you really feel like this sucks. Like this really sucks for this person and the people around them being affected by it. So, I mean, I think probably the apex of that, right, and is the autopsy sequence, which is the most heavy effect single sequence. But what I really love about it, Justin, is the progression of the creature throughout it, right? At first, there are paddles that come out, and you know this person is needing to be revived, and so the doctor is going to revive them. He goes to put the paddles on this character's chest, and something happens that you absolutely don't expect. But beyond that, it's like, what is happening? You know, they try to address the situation, and then this thing just keeps mutating and forming in different ways. There's a line of dialogue in that sequence that is so well delivered when they think they have defeated the thing in this moment.
And, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And then in the background, John Carpenter shoots it like an absolute pro. You know, Kurt Russell's looking in one direction, and behind him on the floor is moving something else, not in focus yet.
Yeah.
Another character turns around and says, like, you got to be kidding me. It's just like,
It's perfect.
It's a perfect. It's perfect. What about humor in this movie, Justin? Let's touch on that real quick. It's so like sprinkled, but I feel like so in the perfect places to make this not a nihilistic, like let's just dive down the black hole kind of experience.
Right. I think it reinforces that Carpenter is really trying to say something about humanity, right? And that even in our darkest times, I mean, I'm sure we've all been in dark situations, and I've been in some really chaotic situations where people somehow still, well, there's an edge of humor, right? And everyone's different, right? So, which I think is another great thing about this movie, where some people, you know, when confronted with like some super life or death situations, not everyone reacts the same way, right? And so, the humor in here, though, is it never feels like it's being played for a laugh. It feels like it's being played because this is what this character would say if they were real. What I love is, one of Kurt Russell's best lines, I think, in this movie, because of how true it's just delivered, is when he has locked up a certain character in the shed, right?
Uh-huh.
And he says, you know, hey, watch out, you gotta be careful who you trust, essentially, I'm paraphrasing. And Kurt Russell says, tell you what, why don't you just trust in the Lord?
Yeah.
And he walks out.
Yeah.
And I thought, that is so, it's so good.
Yes.
Because... Okay. Like, in one sense, is he just being, like, blasphemous? Yeah, maybe that's it. You know, that's a pretty solid read, I think. But in another sense is, like, you talked about going below the epidermis. Is it, like, shoot, wouldn't it just be easier if, I could just revert to that now?
Yeah.
Can't I do that? Will that help me? So it's a layered line, I think, with a delivery that is in my opinion, at least, it's layered too. Like, it comes off super snarky, but it's not just like, you know, some flippant remark.
No.
And I think it's also supposed to be a little funny, right? Like, just the juxtaposition of, like, here's aliens from outer space. How does the Bible, how does God fit into this? What are we doing?
Yeah.
And just the kind of absurdity. It's like black humor, I suppose.
Yeah, it's like gallows humor. Oh, and well, that's a little on the nose for what happens later with that.
Hello.
Wilford Brimley plays one of the characters in this movie, perhaps. Okay, fine. He's the one he locks in the shed.
Perhaps, yeah.
He might
be. I heard Ryan Reynolds might have a part in this movie as a small mouse.
As Deadpool. Yeah. Deadpool the mouse. Anyway.
That would have made this better.
Wilford Brimley is so freaking good in this movie. Like we said, everybody is. So we probably don't have time to say this person is so freaking good, but I just want to highlight him because I feel like he has one of the most like range-tastic jobs, you know, in the whole script.
Absolutely.
He is so like somber and like he is the guy who does have it all figured out, you know, for the first 40 minutes of the movie or whatever. And then when that goes south, it goes south in such an interesting way that like it just leaves nothing to the imagination as far as, okay, if these dudes are in fact in Antarctica, there's this pervading understanding that like people, they go sometimes, man. He's gone.
Yeah.
You know, and like that's just like true of like, you know, soldiers at war. And, you know, we talk about PTSD so much now these days and whatever. And the like isolation, you know, anxiety and paranoia and all that stuff. And so this, to me, Justin, his depiction up until the very last moment you see him is, it is so incredibly like diverse. He does so many different things in this movie. But I think the moment that this doesn't much, I don't think spoil anything, where that really, really impresses me is when he's like hulking out with that axe in that, in that like control room. He's incredibly, I know this guy as the guy from the diabetes infomercial growing up, you know?
Right.
Wilford Brimley and I have diabetes, you know? And it's like,
diabetes.
Yeah. And he's like, he is so freaky in this movie. Like, in so many ways. And then the other guy I really like, you know, if we're just going to highlight a couple secondary characters for one line, is Donald Moffat as Gary. He's supposed to be what, like the commanding officer? I don't know. Does he have a rank? I don't even know.
They call him captain once.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's not, I feel like this movie is so unclear.
Yeah.
In a good, it's almost like you got dropped in.
Yeah.
To the group of these guys.
Figure it out
if you can. If you can't, like whatever. And so I don't know, man. Honestly, like because it's like, okay, he has this revolver on, but that wasn't like standard issue in the 80s. You know,
sure.
He's got like a Western gun belt.
Yeah.
So is he like a self-appointed, like I'm the law around here?
Doesn't he seem slightly, Justin, like he is the one character that John Carpenter took that like claw machine thing from the arcade game and plucked out of the 51 movie and just kind of plopped into his movie?
Oh, absolutely.
And yet it like works. It totally works. Do you know what line I'm talking about that he has? That's like,
oh yeah,
it might be the best line of the movie, I think.
Yeah.
After the wonderful blood test sequence.
Yes.
I don't even know, man. It's like, there's so many things in there. There's the practical effects working beautifully again, but the character drama in that scene, man, is like the highs and lows of what Kurt Russell's character has to go through when he makes choices that have, you know, lifelong consequences. But the interplay between them really starts to, I feel like maybe you get to know them more and more as the movie goes along. Is that fair to say? You know, like they don't all devolve into the same selfish organism. You do in fact get more cues into their character.
Right.
And that line he has at the end of the blood test sequence is, I think, the best cue to his.
Yeah, absolutely. And in speaking of cues and that scene, I just find it so impressive if you can just like step back as a viewer and think about what did those actors like go through shooting, you know, this scene on this particular day or whatever. So for you know, the character of Gary and of Childs to be sitting on the couch when something horrible happens.
Yes.
Just think, like, it's just amazing to me, Travis. There's no sound design. They're not listening to anything.
Yeah.
When they have to react the way they do.
Yes.
And they're certainly not seeing what we're seeing.
No.
But my gosh, the way that is shot, it is so convincing that everything is happening and sounding and feeling like it does when you watch it.
They sell the absolute crap out of those moments. Like one of the things that is so stellar about all these performances is like when you see these things in this movie, you have like these guttural like, ugh, like feelings. And everything they're doing on screen is echoing it in a movie way, but also in a way that, like, I could see myself flipping the crap out, like, you know, just like any one of these guys, even these guys who seem like they have their cool together.
Right.
And then at the end of the blood test sequence, he's the only one who's still tied up after all of that. And he says, like, I know you gentlemen have been through a lot, but when you find the time, I'd rather not spend the rest of this winter tied to this couch. It's like...
Yeah.
It's so good. He's holding it together until he can't anymore. Poor Gary.
Back to Mr. Diabetes, too.
Yes.
So if you ever get a chance, I recommend watching the movie with the commentary that Kurt Russell and John Carpenter did.
Oh, really? Okay.
So you remember, Travis, when Walter Brimley's character is doing the autopsy from the body thing at the Norwegian camp they found? And he's got a really good grimacy face. And... And John Carpenter asked him, he said, what were you thinking about? I mean, and And if you think, why would John Carpenter ask him that? It's because the grimace is that good, people.
It's a good
it just
grimace.
Looks like this dude is digging through a body.
Yeah,
it really looks like
that. He's
got
a good snarl going in that scene. It's pretty good.
And so Mr. Brimley's response was dirty laundry. So, you know, it's just that just gives you an insight into that gentleman. And apparently in his acting prowess, holy crap, if he can conjure up that kind of emotion from thinking about laundry, what's he going to do when he thinks about the Holocaust?
Oh, my goodness. So,
well, that's enough for today.
We should, in fact, let's put up a spoiler wall, Justin. Ready? Knock, knock, knock. Bricks, mortar. Here's a spoiler wall. Here come spoilers. If you have not seen John Carpenter's 1982 masterpiece, The Thing, don't listen any further. Just don't, because everything we've been saying so far has just been tiptoeing around the tulips. But we are going to talk about the ending of this movie because, Justin, John Carpenter's ending is not the 1951 ending, my friend. It is
a little different.
Something very different. So now that we're past the spoiler wall, we can get to the point where we can say most of the people in this movie don't make it out in one piece, if at all. And at the end, you've got the two characters who, I don't know, probably have the most friction throughout more of the movie than the others. And there's lots of friction. It's Kurt Russell and Keith David, MacReady and Childs. They've already come past the point where he's like, we're not making it out of this alive. They've blown everything, the crap up. And Keith David's character has been missing for a while, which of course is very suspicious. He sits down and they just have this freaking, it's not even just good. It is a poetic exchange of dialogue. It is so, so well acted and written and shot. And this movie ends on one of the coolest lines. And John Carpenter just knows how to end a movie, right, Justin? Mm-hmm. Like, we've both seen Escape from New York, and, you know, if you've seen Halloween, that movie has a freaking amazing ending. This one, this is a special one, Justin. Why do you love the ending of this movie?
It is poetic, like you talked about, and it just, I think it cuts through all the friction, right? Because these characters in the original screenplay, and apparently a lot of the original footage, there's a lot more of Kurt Russell or of MacReady and Childs, like, just having banter and arguing with each other and stuff, and that all got cut, which I'm not complaining about, because what's left is just perfect.
Yeah.
But you've got these guys who, you know, if there was anything that was non-alien in this movie that was an enemy, you know, it would be these two guys in the movie. And they're at the end of the day, if your whole base in Antarctica is blown up and you haven't slept for like 4 days.
Yes.
What choice is there, really? Like, you cannot exist by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, the movie says that, I don't know if I can trust you, but I don't have a choice.
Yeah.
Because I'm just human. I have tried to figure stuff out on my own. I have tried to just power on through and pull myself up my bootstraps. I'm not strong enough. I can't do it. I'm not godlike. So I have to just sit here and take what comes and hope that I can trust you.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a true lesson for life. It's not always as stark as that, right?
Well,
thank goodness I don't have to deal with like too many aliens at work.
Yeah.
But like that is reality. You have to, you cannot just be an island. Like, there's plenty of great 80s songs about that.
Yep.
You have to, at some point, if you want to live, you have to live in community with people. If you really want to live, if you just want to exist, hey man, go up to Tibet or whatever mountain and just hang out. But I don't mean to cause any of our Tibetan fans to leave, Travis. I don't want that to happen again.
No, that
would suck. But the ending to me just says it's a beautiful button because it has that, Travis. But it's also, the ending to me says, I have made a perfect movie in a non-arrogant way, right?
And we are done now. Yes.
My takeaway is like, oh my goodness, like. That's why it's a creative concept that is perfectly executed. It's a great story that's unencumbered by a studio somehow.
Yes.
I mean, I don't get it, frankly. But
no,
I
don't know if studio notes do not leave to these final three lines, right? MacReady says, if we've got any surprises for each other, I don't think we're in much shape to do anything about it, which absolutely speaks to what you just said. And Child says, well, what do we do? Last line of the movie. Why don't we just wait here for a little while, see what happens. Boom.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, what, you can't, yeah, you can't top that. This thing is, it's done. It's done, Justin. We are done, but we are not to the final question, which in this case is, are these worth your time? Yes. Now you go.
Exit music.
Yeah, no, I think for very different reasons, they're both worth your time. I think, and I don't say this lightly, and I'm kind of a dork and a nitpicker when it comes to movies, if you haven't figured that out from listening to this podcast, I think this makes the list for me, man, of perfect movies. Like, they're not that common, but when you see one, you know it. And there's not a frame of this thing, not a line, not a sequence that I would change. This is the 1982 one I'm talking about now. I just love John Carpenter. I think there's something about the artistry plus the economy that he wields in the director's chair. Like, there's just like of you know, and I haven't seen his entire filmography. I'm not one of those people that has watched through his filmography like six times, but like, of all of the Carpenter I've seen, which is a fair amount, I never ever finish a John Carpenter movie thinking like, that should have ended 20 minutes ago. It never happens. And yet everything that's packed in there is so well executed. So like, just the way the camera moves in this movie, Justin, we didn't even talk about it, but like, the way the camera moves is so stinking purposeful. Nothing extraneous. And that's true of the storytelling. It's true of the performances he gets out of his actors. It's so good. Even if you're not like a horror movie fan, I think that perhaps there's something in this for people who just sort of dip their toe into the pool every once in a while because of how well constructed it is and how much it speaks to people and humanity and what it says about, you know, trusting other people and what it says about, you know, thinking about your own depravity in high pressure situations. The Thing from Another World, 1951, it's just a fun time. I think it's a good, tense popcorn flick from 1951, and it absolutely delivers on everything you would expect that kind of movie to deliver on. Not to mention what it does do differently from the 82 really well, because it's trying to, and the 82 is sort of trying not to, is like, develop real people on screen, even in a package that's kind of, I don't know, plasticky at times, and, you know, big score and bum 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 moments. There's moments in there that are really, like you touched on, warm and inviting and nice. So both worth your time. I would rewatch the 51 again, but I don't know. It's probably not an every year movie. In a few years, I might pop it in again and watch it. I could absolutely watch John Carpenter's The Thing every October. It just is a great, like, you know, pop it in, as you were saying, Justin. This feels like a movie that needs to be popped into a VCR somewhere every October. So that's my answer. How about you?
Yeah, pretty similar thoughts. I would rewatch either of these again, and they're both worth your time for different reasons. But if you had to choose between which one to watch, I mean, skip right over the 51 version and come to 82. The last thing I'll say about why I think it's worth your time, and tell me, Travis, if I'll say what I have to say, and then you let me know if it's lecturing. I don't want to lecture anybody.
Sure.
But
it's lecturing.
And outro music. I think that this movie for me, it has such power, and you talked about you know, people not being into horror that might still like this. I think that's true if you can find some purpose in the gore is what's gonna, if you're not a fan of the genre, I think the gore for this movie is what's gonna turn you off, if anything is. And so to me, I find the gore in this movie not to be like some other movies of like the body horror subgenre. To me, this says that this is such a naked depiction of just how gross evil is. Right?
Yeah.
This monster is not dressed up. It's not like, oh man, that's kind of a cool thing. Oh, he killed somebody. That was pretty cool. None of it's cool. None of it's fun to look at. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Right. And like you said about having it burned in your memory, it's burned in mine too, dude. Those images will be in there. But I think what's so cool and what makes this movie worth your time is that is like what's underneath people that are evil, right? And that's the true nature of evil. And it may like be able to masquerade and look like something that is appealing, but if you remove that mask, it's gross and you want nothing to do with it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so I love that, at least to me, this movie speaks in that way. The last thing, I guess it'll be a question actually, Travis.
Sure.
For you, my friend. Let's imagine there's a alternate cinematic universe that is not owned by Marvel, and there's a mashup. You know, we used to have those monster like mashup movies.
Oh yeah.
How would it go if it was the Thing from 1951, the monster mm-hmm. from the 1951 Thing versus the Thing from 1982?
Well, they both like blood. Mm-hmm. one of them, perhaps. Is slower, less agile. The 1982 Thing would it would do horrible, unspeakable, hellish things to that poor man in that rubber suit. That's yeah. the answer.
I was thinking the 51 version might just tinkle his winkles and be done with it.
Oh man, well I tinkle my winkles when I watch this again, Justin. All right, man. Well, that was a blast. Loved both the movies. Next week, we're back to our normal scheduled programming. This was a little bit of a bonus for people. It's a movie from France called Elevator to the Gallows.
Oh, that's right. Yes. I'm excited for this one, man.
With a score, Justin, by a man whose name is Miles Davis. And
yeah.
It should be interesting.
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know if it'll be good, but it should be interesting.
It should be. We haven't watched a French movie in a while, but I'm ready. Oh.
Okay.
Let the movie speak. Speak.
Hey, since you're still here and still listening, thank you, by the way, we'd like to ask an additional favor of you.
We have social media. It's a thing on the internet. And all you need to do is find us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and like and subscribe. I know this is annoying, but we have to ask you because we want more people to hear the show. In addition to that, if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we would greatly appreciate it. See you next week. Bye.